Hello and welcome to the Martian Driving Podcast 135. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around, two incredibly different movies. Again, incredibly different movies. The first one's a Hammer horror film from 1957 called The Abominable Snowman, also known as The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas, starring Peter Cushing and Forrest Tucker. Then we move on to 1972. For a Hitchcock pastiche that I first saw in about 72, and it scared the fuck out of me at the time. And that is Sisters, directed by Brian De Palma, and starring Margot Kidder, Jennifer Salt, and William Finley. So really different films, but I've seen them recently, both of them, and I enjoyed them a lot. So sit back and get the contact details out of the way, and I can get the show to start. Martian Driving Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, so how's everybody doing? Yeah, it's winter here, and yes, it sucks, but not as much as it did last year. Now, I think I've figured it out why. Now, excuse me while I digress before I get into the science fiction and horror movie stuff, but I've worked out why winter isn't hitting me as horribly as it did last year. And you ready for it? I don't have to get up in the mornings. So I'm not having that horrible experience, which I've hated ever since it happened, ever since I moved to Melbourne in 1990. I had that horrible experience that some of the year, in the colder months, I get up in the dark and come home from work in the dark. And that always sat wrong with me. It felt like my day was being stolen with not enough recompense. And I don't feel it this year because I'm not working. Anytime I choose to, I can go out into the open air. I can stand under a sky without a roof in between me and it. And I can do things. This week we went to the zoo again and we hung out with the meerkats. I got a bit of writing for the YouTube channel done, sitting in the cafe at Melbourne's Werribee Zoo. And we took some great footage of some lions and hippos and other animals, and in general had a good morning and out in the open air, even though it was a bit cold. And you got to expect that this time of year. And the lions have a heated area of their enclosure close to the glass so that they can stay warm during the weather. And all the animals have kind of weather-appropriate heating in their enclosures. It's an open-range zoo. But it kind of occurred to me as I was driving home from Werribee Zoo this week that that's the reason why it doesn't hit me as much, is that I can choose to be in the open air. I can choose to have daylight and sunshine without anybody telling me I had to be doing something else, apart from Sal. But, you know, I can always negotiate through and between obligations if I need to. But it's a very much a different experience than it was. And I kind of like that. It makes the year a bit less burdensome for me to be able to be out in the daytime whenever I choose to, without people, you know, basically not having a boss in a sense. There's two good things about retirement. A, they give you discounts on certain things for just not dying. And B, you kind of stop having a boss. And that's probably the best thing for human beings. I think negotiating in groups and getting projects done is fantastic. And that can be a wonderful thing. And it's something that I do enjoy a lot. But basically, working to make other people rich was never something that's that comfortable with me. I think I'm a little bit too socialist and Bolshevik for that. But, yeah, so this year's kind of been interesting from that point of view. And while we're on the subject of being out in the open air and doing things that I couldn't do just because I can, tomorrow Sally and I have got a market for her craft work. We're doing that on Sunday, so I'm recording this on Saturday night. And then on Monday morning, I'm taking the dreaded train to Sydney again to visit my mum and my sister and my brother-in-law and my nephew. and kind of, you know, getting a bit of time seeing mum again, because I'm not sure how many times I'll be able to do it. So I kind of got a couple of projects to keep me busy on that endless 11-hour ride up to the Harbour City. A lot of people have said to me, why didn't I fly? Yeah, I could have flown and it wouldn't have been too much more expensive. But what I have more of these days is time than money. And it's cheaper to take the train. And I thought I could get a YouTube video for the YouTube channel out of the trip. I've got a really nice gimbal. The gimbal is the thing. You put your smartphone into the gimbal. And I've got quite a good smartphone at the moment, fortunately. And when you move it around and take video with it, it kind of acts like a Steadicam, a computerized Steadicam, to keep the video flowing smoothly. You don't get that, if you're walking, you don't get that jerkiness on the video from walking. You can do other good things on it, like you can mount it on a tripod and do time lapse. So you can even do panning time lapse where it slowly pans across as the time lapse is happening. So there are lots of groovy things I can do with this very light gimbal that I've got. It's a handheld one for the most part when you don't put it on a tripod. So I'm taking that along with me. I'm taking a ton of recharging bricks so I don't run out of mobile juice on the smartphone. And I'm taking my Kindle so I can read some books. I'm currently reading the novel on which one of my favorite films was based, 2 Weeks in Another Town. So I'm reading Irwin Shaw's novel, which is very different from the movie in a lot of ways, but very similar in others. So I'm reading that at the moment. I'm also going to be taking my Lenovo Android tablet with me, which I've stacked a bunch of movies to watch on. So I've got that. That recharges to a power brick as well if I need it. I'm also taking a small laptop. So if I want to get some writing done, I can do that. That too charges off a power brick if I need to. So I've got about 4 power bricks all charged up and ready to go. I've got a whole bunch of technology there. And so what I thought I'd do is a couple of things. First thing I'll do is I'll kind of vlog the trip to Sydney as much as I can. I'm not sure how the sound quality is going to go on a train, but I'll give it a go. And the other thing I'm going to do is catch up on some movies. And that should kind of be fun. It's interesting the power you've got in a phone now. You can technically record, edit, and upload a feature film using a mobile phone about as powerful as what I've got, which is a Google Pixel XL 2, all while sitting in one place as long as you've got enough power to recharge the phone. I'm not going to be doing that because it's a major pain in the ass to do that, but I will at least get B-roll. I'll do a bit of vlogging to camera. I'll use the gimbal to kind of walk along the train and show people what the train's like inside it. I'll also take some landscape stuff. I want to do some slow-mo landscape stuff as well. I've got a slow-mo mode on the camera, which will do 4K video in slow motion, which shows you how powerful phones are these days. So I'm going to be doing a bit of that. So when I get back from the trip, and I'm leaving on Monday, coming back on the train Thursday morning and get home Thursday night. So it's not going to be a long trip to Sydney. But I really want to kind of experiment with video logging, vlogging for YouTube, and see what I can come up with and see what kind of creativity I can unleash in myself while I'm doing that. And I really enjoy it. I put together a brief video. If you go to my YouTube channel, type Terry Frost, Werribee Zoo, or something like that into YouTube, you'll find the channel in the video. And if you want to subscribe to the channel, I'd really appreciate it. And watch the videos as well, of course. But I put together in 2 hours, I edited together all of the video from the last zoo trip we did. And I'm kind of happy with it. It's not perfect. It's very raw in places. And I've also kind of experimented with time compression, speeding up the video a little bit to go through some slow bits and to achieve certain effects with it. And I kind of like that. I like the fact that I understand more about movies by making little movies myself than I did before. It really does help with that knowledge of what other people do creatively to make your own film. And I remember a couple of years ago, somebody said to me, have you ever thought of making your own films? And went, no, I just watch them and review them and do that kind of shit. But now I've kind of turned around on that because there's that democratization of video that the platforms like YouTube give us. unleashing that creativity and having a great time with it and just kind of grooving with the power of having something in your pocket where you can do 4K video and you can do time-lapse and you can do slow-mo and you can even make a phone call with it is, for me, a new kind of fun. And I really do appreciate it. And maybe that's what I'm going to be doing now, is kind of having the podcast as well. I love the podcast. Please don't think that I'm going to desert you people, because I'm not. But having that other thing that I do, which is similar, creative, and fun, and visual as well, is a joy for me. Now, what have I been watching? Not a lot. I did watch Deadpool 2, which Sally and I saw and enjoyed a lot. I love the fourth wall breaking. I love the transgressiveness of it. There are a couple of issues with it that people have brought up to me with refrigerated women. And you might want to Google that if you're not sure what that is. But I like a lot of what it does. I like the fact that it breaks that fourth wall. It's meta. It references other works in the genre. And it is a superhero movie that knows it's a superhero movie, which is one of the great joys of it. So we kind of had fun with that. And then the only other thing I've really seen is Dirty Grandpa, which is not the best Robert De Niro movie ever made, to be honest with you. But it does have a couple of moments of fun and naughtiness. It got some very bad reviews. It's also got Zac Efron in it and Aubrey Plaza. And I kind of liked it. It didn't offend me, because I'm pretty hard to offend with certain things, particularly if it's dirty jokes. But it was okay. I picked it up on Netflix and watched it and didn't have a particular problem with it. And to be honest, I really like De Niro when he's playful. Doing a serious role, yeah, there's nobody in the world that's done what he's done better. But him just kind of being playful and silly even at times is something that I kind of like. Apart from that, I've only been watching kind of episodic TV, a lot of documentaries on YouTube and things like that, but nothing particularly worth mentioning at the moment. I've got to be a bit more assiduous about my YouTube documentary documenting, so that I can let you know what I've been watching. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about The Abominable Snowman, a 1957 Hammer horror film starring Peter Cushing and Forrest Tucker, written by the guy that gave us Quatermass, the great Nigel Neal.
A small band of men on a perilous search for the man-beast of Tibet, the abominable snowman of the Himalayas. You've heard of him, haven't you? The world's most shocking monster. No one's ever lived who's seen him. Be on your guard. He's coming to this theater. The abominable snowman dares you. We dare you. Dare you to see the abominable snowman of the Himalayas.
Ah! What did it look like? Tell me, what did you see, Kusang? Tell me.
I see what men must not see.
They're after me. They know it was me that did it last night. They're after me.
They're after all of us. They just killed McNee.
Why, oh, said that? It was an accident.
It's me next. They know it was me. Stay here.
Ed, wait.
Ed, I can hear you. I'm coming.
You've got to understand, that isn't Shelley. It isn't anybody.
I can hear his voice.
It's in your own mind. It's just happened to me, too.
Warning. Only those with stout nerves and strong hearts should risk seeing the abominable snowman of the Himalayas.
Yeah, it's a very bombastic 1957 kind of trailer, that one, isn't it? But the film is interesting enough that I thought it was worth doing on the podcast. It wasn't a big film. It was filmed widescreen in black and white. And it was based on a television play that Nigel Neal had done with Peter Cushing, amongst others, and some of the other minor character roles in 1955. It was filmed twice. They broadcast it once and then broadcast it again live a little bit later. So the whole thing was done live on television in the same way that the first Quatermass TV thing was done by Nigel Neal. An interesting thing was that the Tom Friend role, which in this movie is played by Forrest Tucker, was played by Stanley Baker. I would love to see that, but nothing exists except some still shots from that original version of this story, which was known in 1955 as The Creature. The story is fairly simple, but it has some nice twists. I'm going to spoil the twist towards the end, but I'll get there and I'll let you know before I do. In this one, Peter Cushing plays a Dr. John Rollison, who with his wife Helen, played by Maureen Connell, and his assistant Peter Fox, played by Richard Watters, are living in a lamasery called Rongbuk in the Himalayas on a botanical expedition. He's a botanist. They meet up with a second expedition led by Tom Friend, played by Forrest Tucker, accompanied by a trapper called Ed Shelley, played by Robert Brown. Robert Brown, you probably best know for being the second guy to play M in the James Bond movies after Bernard Lee died. But before that, he had tons and tons of roles. He played a caveman in 1 million years BC, for instance, and all sorts of other character roles. He was a sidekick to Roger Moore in the Ivanhoe TV series in the late 1950s before he became James Bond's boss in some of the Roger Moore films later on. Tom Friend, the Forrest Tucker characters. If I ever say Forrest Whitaker during this podcast, I apologise up front because there's a tendency when you have a first name Forrest to say Whitaker these days rather than Tucker. So I apologise if I've done that, or I will do that. But anyway, he is out to trap a Yeti. They've got a Yeti tooth, which they found in India, and his mob are basically there to track down and hunt a Yeti. They've got a whole bunch of equipment. They've got tungsten steel, netting, and all sorts of other gear, rifles and stuff, so they can go up into the top end of the Himalayas and get themselves a Yeti, because he wants to take it back and show it on television, make a fortune, do all that kind of stuff. We later find out that he was basically a carnival huckster who was willing to take a Himalayan ape that they capture back to civilization and tell people it's a Yeti. But at this stage, it's still early. Rollison agrees to go along with Friend's expedition to find the Yeti, and they head up way above where they think the Yetis are, and they're going to kind of come down on them from above and capture one. Things, as you might think, don't go to plan. One of the party, who's a very poor climber, a guy called McNee, played by Michael Brill, is basically holding them back. He's slow, he's not particularly adept as a climber, and he's one of those guys that has something to prove. And so things don't go well. He gets his foot caught in a bear trap that is left there by Friend to try to trap a Yeti. After much travail and blizzards and all sorts of other things, minor avalanches, they manage to shoot a Yeti, and they keep its body, which enrages the other Yetis. It pisses them off, as you might understand it would. So hiding in a cave, they try to trap a live Yeti, but things aren't going quite to plan, because there seems to be something very, very odd about these creatures. Here come the spoilers. Rollison, the Peter Cushing character, is a rationalist. He's a scientist. He doesn't have a particular urge to catch the Yeti for personal reasons. He wants to find out what it is and understand it in the same way a botanist would understand a plant. But they slowly find out that the Yetis are in some ways telepathic and are messing with their minds. They increase the fear that McNee has until ultimately it kills him. And they do the same with the Robert Brown character, the hunter, Shelley. Now, it's implied and said by the characters that these monsters are very large, very strong, and very fast. We don't get a lot of viewing of that because the technology wasn't there to portray that particularly well. And so Nigel Neal, using one of his great strengths as a screenwriter, does a lot of things by suggestion and inference rather than through directly showing it to us. The movie is made in two places. First off, Bray Studios. They put together a lamasery set in Bray Studios, which was later used for some of the Fu Manchu movies that Christopher Lee did about a decade later. And also, they did some second unit filming with doubles for the actors. up in the Pyrenees. There are some nice helicopter shots of people climbing up mountain ridges in the Pyrenees that are covered with snow. And also if some of the shots were actually captured from a cable car going up to a resort. So between the two, they get some pretty good second unit stuff, better than the movie might be expected to have had by doing that second unit location. It really does kind of lift the movie up and keep it from being very much set bound, which the rest of the movie pretty much is. They did a lot of the snow using a weird combination. I found this out and I thought, ugh. But the snow was made of a combination of styrofoam and salt. Now, they were blowing that snow into people's faces, so I'm not sure how that went with the actors. But one way or the other, they kind of carried it off as best you could expect for a 1957 movie. These days, things that are filmed on a set are done a lot better because you've got green screens that can make things look like they're outdoors when they're indoors. They can make it look like an alien planet when they're in a factory. But that kind of set-bound look doesn't play as well to our eyes than it did to our ancestors' eyes, let's say. But nonetheless, the movie does have a nice... it moves along at a good pace. The revelations about the nature of the Yetis and that the expedition survivors finally find out some things about them, including the fact that they're a lot smarter and wiser than we are, and that they're just waiting for humanity to destroy itself in a nuclear war so that they can come down out of the highlands and populate the planet, which is a kind of an interesting twist, and it's a very Nigel Neal thing. He didn't want to do a straight-up monster movie with this one or a straight-up monster story when he did the original 1955 teleplay. What he wanted was to take it, give it a twist and to turn it around so it's an outsider's look at human beings. And the party that go up there, apart from Rollison, played by Peter Cushing, are not the best examples of humanity. McNee is a man who's scared and has to prove his masculinity. The hunter, Shelley, is a brute. And Tom Friend, the character played by Forrest Tucker, is a bully and one of those kind of belligerent, kind of cock-proud Yanks that we see in a lot of movies. And I said use cock prow for a reason, because Forrest Tucker, as we know, had one of the largest dicks in Hollywood. He was up there with Milton Berle and a couple of others, Sinatra, in that he had an enormous dick. There are some other interesting actors in here as well. There aren't many people playing people of their own ethnicity, which is something very common for a movie in the 1950s. The guy playing the Lama in the Lamasery was actually a German actor who fled the Nazis. His name was Arnold Marley. And he had a career in, I think he worked for UFA in the 1920s, the German film company. And then in the 30s started doing English language films and moved away from Germany for reasons that are obvious to anybody who knows about the Second World War. His wife's uncle was Sigmund Freud, which is the only thing I could find out about Arnold Marley. But he does a kind of good job as the Lama, very much in the same way of the... he reminds me a little bit of the kind of the Lama in Shangri-La in the original version of Lost Horizon, which is probably the go-to characterization for people portraying Tibetan Lamas. And Arnold Marley brings to it a kind of slightly scary serenity. And so he's quite good in it. Forrest Tucker's surprisingly good in the movie as well. Some of the people who worked on the film didn't like him in it. Nigel Neal thought he was good in the role. But he does the role kind of well. Peter Cushing, of course, is great in this. And Helen Connell playing his wife, who didn't have a kind of incredibly successful film career, is quite good in it. She's very underwritten as a character. And she's only there kind of to flesh things out and give another subplot to the story, which allowed them to extend the running time to a decent 91 minutes for cinema release. But she kind of works in there. Richard Watters, who spent his career playing bureaucrats and school teachers, is a little bit out of place playing Rollison's assistant, but he doesn't kind of, you know, he's not a waste of space in this one. And it's good to see him step out of kind of home counties, England, and do something set somewhere else for once in his career. There are a couple of minor actors. Anthony Chang playing the major domo of the Lama is of Asian descent, as indeed are a lot of the extras. And what they did was the usual thing they did in Britain in the 1950s when they wanted to portray anything Asiatic, and this lasted well into the 1970s. They emptied out every waiter from Chinese restaurants in London and made them extras in the film, gave them money. You know, they were on a nice earner there for not doing too much at all. And so there are a lot of people in the background of suitable ethnicity, or at least close to suitable ethnicity. But again, that kind of casting for the correct ethnicity wasn't something that they really could do at the time, and it isn't something they were particularly interested in doing at the time. We know a lot better now, particularly in the last 5 years, where that's become very much a major issue in cinema. And I think cinema's richer for it too. Having people of the right ethnicity playing characters lets them use their own personal lived experience to inhabit the characters. And it's also important for young people of various ethnicities and various colours to see people who look like them and who have their own, the same cultural and social background as them reflected in cinema. So if people were remaking this, I think it would be a very different looking movie. And I think it is something you could probably remake as maybe a Netflix movie, because the twist of having the Yetis being wise and intelligent and much more so than us and telepathic, without being more violent and malicious than they have to be, is kind of interesting. And just to finish off the spoilers in this film, there is a strongly implied ending to the film, which implies, there are two ways you could read the ending, where Rollison reaches civilization again with his wife and with Richard Waters, fortunately, because it's not nice to see Richard Waters die in a movie. When he gets back to civilization, he denies the existence of Yetis. Now, there can be two readings of that. The first one is that he wants them to hide. He doesn't want to let people know they're there. That's a valid interpretation of it. But given the kind of psychic abilities that have been manifest by these creatures, there's also the ability to read this text as they wiped his mind of any knowledge of Yetis, which is kind of a much more interesting and slightly scarier interpretation at the end of this film. I'm going with the latter on this one, because I like the idea that the way they've stayed hidden is to take away the knowledge of their existence from people. And there's an interesting thing there too, that the Lamaserie and the Lamas act as gatekeepers to keep people away from the Yetis, whether they do that in a collaborative way or whether they do that because they've been programmed by the Yetis to do that is something that you can have an argument about and discuss endlessly if you want to. Now, there are a couple of streaming platforms that have this movie. I think Vimeo has it. If you do a Google video search on The Abominable Snowman, I think that it's you may well be able to watch it. And if, like me, you wanted to see as many Hammer films as possible, particularly ones that have kind of slipped between the cracks for me a little bit, then you'll want to see The Abominable Snowman. And as I said, in America it was called The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas. But for me, I like The Abominable Snowman. I think it's kind of redundant to say of the Himalayas, because there aren't really many abominable snowmen of the Kalahari, for instance. Though that'd be kind of interesting. But, yeah, it kind of does have that slight creepiness about it. It shows the genius of Nigel Neal in kind of subverting a monster movie paradigm by having the monsters be the less monstrous of the two antagonistic parties. And that's kind of cool, and it's something that I really enjoy. I've got a copy of Nigel Neal's TV series Monsters on a box set of that, so I really should dip into more Nigel Neal. I think I'll have a bit of fun if I do that. But that's about it for The Abominable Snowman. Check it out. You're really going to like it. It's not paced particularly fast, but it bears close attention when you're watching it. So I'm going to take a break now, play a little bit of Bernard Herrmann's music from Sisters, then the trailer from Sisters, and talk about the 1972 movie Sisters, directed by Brian De Palma, starring Margot Kidder and Jennifer Salt, and very much made as an homage to Alfred Hitchcock.
Conjoined twins called Siamese challenge life at their first breath. Some twins have been separated and lead normal lives. Others never can. Sisters, they were once one in body and perhaps one in mind. Danielle and Dominique, one loving, one hating, one innocent, the other... Where does Danielle end and Dominique begin?
It's okay. No, I can't remember.
Go back, try. Remember.
He's a freak! Freak!
Sisters. Rated R.
As that music by Bernard Herrmann suggests, this is definitely a Hitchcock homage. He was semi-retired at the time, Bernard Herrmann, and De Palma convinced him to do the soundtrack for Sisters, which only cost $500,000 to make. And there are definitely kind of resonances in that music of Vertigo and North by Northwest even. They give this one a special punch to it, even though there are moments during the film where it almost sounds like Bernard Herrmann is pastiching himself and his previous works. Nonetheless, the music is really exceptional in certain scenes. The two main female actors, and there are two strong female actors in this one, Margot Kidder, who died recently, as we know, and Jennifer Salt, were actually co-inhabitors of a beach house in Malibu in the early 1970s. People like Scorsese and De Palma and John Milius, who gets name-checked in this movie, amongst others, kind of hung out there. Spielberg did as well. They hung out at Jennifer Salt and Margot Kidder's beach house, probably to meet girls, but also to talk about movies and to kind of get... it was part of a small colony of houses which were inhabited by movie people, and there was a lot of kind of cross-pollination between the individual people. And one Christmas, Brian De Palma gave Jennifer Salt and Margot Kidder a Christmas present each under the tree. And in that present were the script to Sisters, two copies of it. And so the movie got made. De Palma starts the movie, interestingly, after the strident title cards under which there are photos of developing fetuses in the womb. Some really nice photography of them, by the way, but it ends on a kind of creepy note, as will be expected in this kind of movie, which is about conjoined twins who are separated, and one of whom is not well. From there, they go to a kind of candid camera-style television show where an advertising salesman, Philip Wood, played by an actor called Lyle Wilson, wins a dinner for two at a New York restaurant. He takes with him the other person who was part of the quiz show, a young French-Canadian woman called Danielle Breton, played by Margot Kidder, who's a model and an actress. Interestingly enough, she gets a set of steak knives for being the model and actress, who kind of teases him in this weird candid camera kind of TV show called Peeping Toms. And he wins dinner for two at an African-themed restaurant, and he is a man of colour, which is a kind of what-the-fuck moment in this one. So they have dinner, and they kind of get on nicely, and Danielle gets a little bit drunk, and so they go home to her apartment on Staten Island on the ferry. Now, there are some issues in this part about informed consent. Danielle is pretty much drunk, and Philip can't believe his luck. In the restaurant, the couple get hassled by Danielle's ex-husband, Emile, played by William Finley, who played Winslow Leach in Phantom of the Paradise, another Brian De Palma film. He's also in Brian De Palma's The Fury, playing Roman Dunwoody, a psychic, in a kind of small but important role in that film. But he's kind of creepy. He's got a pencil mustache, short hair, kind of buggy eyes. He's tall and weird looking, and kind of seems to be gaslighting Danielle. I'm not going to do spoilers on this movie as I did on The Abominable Snowman beyond a certain point. So Philip goes home with her, and they find out that Emil is downstairs watching the apartment. So Philip pretends to leave, goes and gets some medication that Danielle needs, and comes back. They spend the night together, which is all very sweet. And in the morning, he goes out to get Danielle a birthday cake because it's her birthday. Things don't go well from there. They spend 26, 28 minutes on this setup for a bit of a twist, in the same way that Hitchcock threw us for a curve in Psycho by having the whole sequence with Janet Leigh at the start of the film. This one plays very much as an homage to that. From there, this movie kind of plays as an homage to three different Hitchcock films, and they're fairly easy to figure out what they are. The first one, of course, is Psycho, from that 26-minute thing before the death of a major character who's been quite important to the previous bits of the film. Sorry, I just dropped something. And then we get a Rear Window moment where Grace Collier, a local journalist, sees what occurs in the apartment and tries to alert the police. Then we get another spin on this with a kind of variation on Hitchcock's Rope. Grace sees a murderer taking place in the apartment. While she's trying to get the police together and they're trying to get to the apartment, the murderer and accomplice, let's say, are trying to hide the body and clean up the mess. And the beautiful thing the De Palma does with this is he does all this in real-time split screen as much as he can. So you see the on one side of the screen or the other, you see the same events and the same moment of filming playing out from different viewpoints. And De Palma's strength in this is he does it in a way that doesn't confuse you as an audience member. It's paced well and designed well enough that your mind can encompass the two different aspects of things that you're seeing in the split screen. Split screen isn't done very much now, but in this movie, I think De Palma does an ace job of it. And he does it with a purpose too. You need to see what's going on, both from Grace's point of view and from the opposing point of view in Danielle's apartment. And that kind of works well. Grace meets up with a local cop who is not happy with some of her journalism, played by a character actor called Dolph Sweet, who played cops a lot in movies. And also his assistant is in there as well. I forget the guy's name, but it doesn't really matter. So he spends time arguing with Grace about what she actually saw from the window. And when they get up in the apartment, it looks like Danielle's there with her ex-husband, Emil, and everything's hunky-dory to a certain extent. And Danielle puts on some of her French-Canadian charm and kind of assuages the kind of dubious suspicions that the police have. Meanwhile, Grace, being an investigative journalist, looks around the apartment because she has the opportunity and finds some clues that things aren't what Emil and Danielle say they are. Grace hires a private detective called Joseph Larch, played by Charles Durning, to help her investigate what's going on and to find out what happened with the murder. Now, Charles Durning's character is kind of interesting. It's played slightly tongue-in-cheek and slightly humorously in there. There's a moment where he tells Grace that he was trained and that this is a craft and an art. He was trained by the Brooklyn Institute of Modern Investigation, which is a little bit funny when you come to think of it. Grace's mother is played by Jennifer Salt's real-life mother in there, and she wants her daughter to get a proper career. The actress is called Mary Davenport, and she's actually Jennifer Salt's mother. And they do play well together because of that. The real-life relationship really does help inhabit the relationship between the two of them, which doesn't get a lot of screen time, but kind of works because it kind of has to work. There are a couple other interesting people in it. Olympia Dukakis turns up as a woman working in a cake shop, which is kind of cool. And Bernard Hughes, a character actor who's done incredible amounts of work over the last 50 or 60 years, plays a journalist who previously investigated the conjoined twins of Dominique and Danielle, who Grace Collier finds out are the actual sisters, and that Danielle is not just a single person, but she's a person with a sister, and they have quite a dark history. The character played by Bernard Hughes, Arthur McLennan, also shows Grace some videotape of the history of Dominique and Danielle as twins, and that gets us into some kind of grainy black and white videotape footage of them as children and as kind of young adults. And there's a really creepy as fuck sequence where the conjoined twins are about to be separated while being watched by quite a creepy audience of people around them, most of whom are identical twins, apart from Bernard Hughes' character, who is there as well, Arthur McLennan. So there's a really kind of surrealistic and creepy as fuck sequence there, which is a bold move again by De Palma, but really kind of works in taking us out of the real world and into a crazy, dysfunctional body horror world that a lot of these characters inhabit. I saw this movie when it first came out, and I was a kind of very young person at the time, and I kind of got sucked in by the start of the film where there's the meet cute of the two people, and he goes back to her apartment, and we do get a couple of nice topless scenes with Margot Kidder there, which would have thrilled me no end as a young boy. And I wasn't expecting the payoff to that sequence. I hadn't seen the trailer. I'd heard about this horror movie called Sisters, and as always, at every opportunity, I was going out and seeing movies. And then suddenly, bam, something happened that blew me away and scared the fuck out of me. And that horror and that creepiness stayed with me for the rest of the movie. And so for 1972, it was a very, very transgressive film. Nobody was doing horror quite at this level of what the fuck in relatively mainstream cinema. This movie got a good release in Australia, possibly because people were told that it was a Hitchcock pastiche in some ways. But the real horror in this stuff and the events that occur as Grace's investigation progresses, and that's the bit I'm not going to spoil, really do make this a freaky horror movie. It's psychological horror. It's body horror as well. It's an homage to another filmmaker. You've got to remember, too, that Hitchcock was still active as a filmmaker in 1972 when Sisters was made. He made Frenzy in the same year this movie came out, and he did Family Plot 4 years later. That was his last two feature films. So he was still around and still working in the industry when De Palma decided to do the homage. Now, a lot of people have said that De Palma was more obsessed with Hitchcock than a lot of the French New Wave filmmakers were, people like Claude Chabrol and François Truffaut. And that's probably true. He really did kind of hang on to that love affair with Hitchcock's work that he had. You see it again in other movies, he's like a possession, blowout and body double, and even in Carrie to a certain extent. That kind of love affair with Hitchcock remained as a part of what De Palma did as a filmmaker, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. He went places where Hitchcock, for reasons of reticence and age, couldn't go, even though Hitchcock was a voyeuristic fuck who loved messing with audiences and totally skull-fucking them with cinema. I think De Palma took that to a different and new level, being a younger filmmaker who was willing to show a lot more gore and horror, and particularly body horror, than Hitchcock would ever have considered doing. And so I like the film for that reason. It really does work for me. Rewatching it now, and I haven't seen it in maybe 20 years, rewatching it now, I can see where the Hitchcock things are a lot more than I did in the past. But I don't mind them. They don't have a negative impact on me. They don't take away from the film at all. And I love the way split screen is used in this film. I love the way that there are two strong female characters in the film, and that they're the people doing the heavy lifting as far as storytelling is concerned. Even though I think Grace is slightly underwritten, nonetheless, she is still the protagonist of the film. And she does have her own life and her own kind of struggles and her own mind. And that's kind of cool. The cops don't believe her. The glass ceiling in those days was a lot lower for journalists. And that's very much reflected in the way that Grace is seen. She's a kind of lifestyle journalist, mostly for a small newspaper on Staten Island, which means she's at the low end of the totem pole as far as journalism in New York's concerned. But she does have strong journalistic instincts. And in some ways, she's persistent and fearless, even when ultimately it doesn't necessarily work to her favour. And Jennifer Salt said this is the best role of her career. And I can believe that. I really like her in this one. I think that she has a believability and a strength in this one that I really admire. The movie ends with some interesting twists, part of which is due to the machinations of Emil, the doctor, played with enormous creepiness by William Finley. And also the persistence of Charles Durning's investigator. There's a kind of coda to the film, which is really interesting, involving a piece of furniture. But rewatching Sisters, I liked it. I really should go with the Criterion Edition and get all the extras when I get the opportunity to, because I think it's an important part of De Palma's work. And in a lot of ways, it is quite an important horror movie for the 1970s. It's one of those movies where you can see a commonality with a lot of the works of Cronenberg at the time and somewhat later than this. It's got a Cronenbergian feel in a lot of ways. And it's, it's, even though he may be playing in Hitchcock's sandbox, he builds different kind of sandcastles in there. Let's just say that. But just to kind of round things off, I enjoyed the film. Even though I knew what was going to happen, I liked watching the step-by-step revelations of what's occurring, because it's the fine detail of those things that you forget over time. And I like the pastiche, the fact that when Philip and Daniel are shown on this sleazy TV show, you see it through the point of view of somebody watching it on TV. You've got the TV-shaped cutout on the screen and the graininess of a slightly marginal television signal on an old-school cathode ray TV as well. And De Palma keeps to that. That point of view really does kind of work, and it shows that he's willing to not just take the easy options. There was going to be a long tracking shot involved in the split-screen stuff as Grace finds out what's happening in the apartment, but apparently De Palma couldn't get it to work because there were technical limitations on where he could put the camera. And so doing a long tracking shot of the incident in Danielle's apartment was something he tried to film. But then when he looked at it in rushes, it just didn't work. So they had to film it a lot differently, which is a bit of a shame, because I would have liked to have seen the other version of it, even if it is, as De Palma has said, a bit silly looking. I would have liked to have seen what he was trying to do. with that tracking shot, because he really wanted to put a kind of long tracking shot in there. But cameras were a lot bulkier in those days. Lighting was a lot more problematic. And so it just wasn't possible for him to do that, which is, again, a bit of a shame. But anyway, we're going to leave it there for now, because I've got a lot of things to do in the next couple of days before I go to Sydney. But check out The Abominable Snowman, a.k.a. The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas. And definitely when you get an opportunity to revisit, if you've seen it before. But if you haven't, see De Palma's Sisters. It is a good horror movie, and I think it's an important one in that 1970s part of the horror genre, because it does things on a fairly small budget, $500,000 I think it was, which much larger horror films at the time just couldn't achieve. So anyway, by the way, as I mentioned last time, we have the wonderful new subscriber, my good friend David Cummer, and David has decided what his credit is going to be for the Patreon support that he gives the podcast at patreon.com/paleocinema. David's role in the Paleo Cinema movie credits is, ready for it, I'll put a drum roll in here, but I'm getting a bit tired this time of night. He's Patriarch of Closed Captioning. So I'm going to incorporate him into the credits at some stage, but I thought I'd name check it right now to give David his full credit. And of course, I'm going to end the podcast with the credits for the Patreon supporters in the style of movie credits. So I'm going to go away now, get some sleep, go to a craft market tomorrow, and then do the incredibly long train trip to Sydney the day after. So look forward to that. So take care of yourselves. Watch good movies, watch bad movies. Keep watching the skies. And I'll be back very soon. Think about doing the Patreon support, because Daddy needs a new microphone at some stage, and you'll feel much better if you do. So take care of yourselves, okay? And I'll be back very soon. I'm not sure whether I'll get a Paleo Cinema out next week or whether it's going to be delayed a little bit. It depends on how I feel after I get back from Sydney and what happens there. But I will at least try to, but the episodes will be back very soon. So take care of yourselves. Here are the credits in the style of movie credits to honour the Patreon supporters. Take care of yourselves. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Driving Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the Focus Puller, Sarah, the Special Effects Technician, Ian, the Caterer, Grant, the Technicolor Consultant, Claire, the Script Doctor, Gary, the Prop Master, Morris, our Musical Director, Jan, our Dialect Coach, Armin, our Key Grip, Matt, the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine, our Scientific Advisor, Julia, the Casting Director, Chris, the Camera Operator, Christopher, the Gaffer, Miss Jane, the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy, our Foley Artist, Alyssa, our Location Scout, Mark, the Second Unit Director, Paul, the Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy, the Donut Wrangler, Tim, our New York Unit Director, Steve, our Spiritual Advisor, Steve Sullivan, our Script Doctor, Dylan, the Goat Wrangler, Eric, the Set Security Lead, Richard H., the Set Photographer, Mark D., the Extra, David L., the Extra, and Richard C., our Transport Co-Captain, plus Andrew, our Necessary Film Critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.